It's been around about the same as seven tradition. And I'm an alcohol to you, Bob. This is Vital Spiritual Awakening 10th anniversary.
All right. Woo!
Yeah, Bob.
Just do a quick group history rundown. About 2 years ago, me and Kevin R. were sitting around complaining about how we needed another meeting that we needed to go to. And we started driving around and looking for churches, and nothing really happened. And the idea kind of, you know, sat around at the diner at times, and we talked about it, complained, and, you know, not taking any action. And, you know, the beginning of last summer, we started to take another crack at it. Nelson V. had moved to this church. His meeting got kicked out of another church. They found this church. I came to a meeting here. I loved the space. And things started to take root. We started to have home group meetings at my house. Kevin was there, Brad, Sue, Vito, Steve, you know, if I don't mention your name. We set a date, and we had a kickoff barbecue at Vito's house, a pool party. And I think we had about 30 or 40 people showed up. And the basket passed around, and it came back with over $300 in it. And which gave us enough money to get the books we needed for the big book meeting. And everybody shared. I remember that night we didn't know how we were gonna do the meeting. And what we did was everybody shared for, like, you know, 10 minutes, and we just kind of picked somebody else. And it was probably still to this day one of the most powerful meetings I've ever been in. You know, I remember Rob sharing at that meeting and breaking down crying for his father calling him on the phone and saying he thought he was dead. And from there, obviously you can see we've made a mark. And I just, like, if anybody, all the home group members, if they could just stand up and kind of be recognized for showing up and. No more delay. Our speaker is Chris. I've known Chris for a couple of years. He's really helped me in my sobriety, and he has an incredible message, and it's very funny on top of that. Not to put any pressure.
No.
Here's Chris.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic. A great crowd. You know, just driving up here, I could tell that this was a good meeting. Everybody's having a good time standing around outside. You can recognize a pocket of enthusiasm a mile away. You can, and I'm lucky. I get to speak sometimes at meetings like this, and it's. You know, to have a meeting that generates enthusiasm is incredibly important in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the things that kills alcoholics is a lack of enthusiasm. A lot of times we know what we need to do. We just don't seem to be able to generate the power or the enthusiasm to go and do it. Sometimes a group like this that's, you know, got vitality is a great place to hang your hat for a home group. I got to tell you, I've been lucky. I've had some good home groups in my day, and the home groups that I've belonged to believe a very lot in the practice of the 12 steps, in service, turning your life into basically a life of service. You know, instilling a service ethic. Within oneself, because that's really what we need, and to become consistent with meetings. That's really the answer that has worked the best for alcoholism, and, you know, really strong groups are very important. You know, I don't only go to big book groups or enthusiastic groups. I go to a lot of different groups, and I was at a meeting last night. And it was a discussion meeting. It was a topic discussion meeting. So at least there was a topic. And this person raised their hand, and they started sharing about all the problems in their life. They started to share about how their ex-husband was, you know, such a jerk and all this, and that they hacked into his email and found all these emails from all of his girlfriends, and you know how this, and this person went on to share for about 10 or 15 minutes about the most god-awful expression of self-centeredness I think I've heard in a long, long time. And you know, I'm sitting in the back. I'm trying to be quiet, but I was horrified. You know, where did somebody get the idea that Alcoholics Anonymous is a place to come in and complain about how crappy their family is, how what kind of a jerk their boss is? Like, how did that happen? You know, and it really got me thinking. Here's basically what happened in Alcoholics Anonymous. Just a brief bit of history. In the early days, what an AA group would look like is people would meet one night a week and get together and commiserate with each other, okay? And then they would talk to each other about, okay, what are you doing tomorrow night? And a group of people would go to a hospital to look for prospects for their group. A group of people would go to the asylums. A group of people would go to the court system, and they would actually go out and try to find prospects for Alcoholics Anonymous, people they could take through the 12 steps. You know, that's what AA looked like in the first 15 years of Alcoholics Anonymous. What it looks like, unfortunately, today in a lot of areas is a lot of people who've become meeting dependent and really think that attending meetings and sharing is practicing a program. And it's not. That is not a program. That may be a fellowship activity. It may even be appropriate at some periods of time. But that's not how you practice a program. Going to meetings does not treat one's alcoholism. What treats one's alcoholism is to practice the 12 steps in one's life. I love the reading today. The teaching and practice of the 12 steps is the sole purpose of an AA group. Well, if that's true, why are there these bizarre discussion meetings where people just dump the garbage of their life onto the floor for everybody to examine? Why is that? And I believe that it happened. I believe it happened over the course of time. But one of the significant things that happened was around 1970, the Hughes Act was passed. And what this did was this gave almost unlimited access to treatment for alcoholism and drug addiction in the hospital systems. Okay, it made it incumbent upon people who had health care systems to treat for alcoholism and drug addiction. So in 1970, there was about 500,000 people in Alcoholics Anonymous. 1970, that bill passes, and you can't shake a stick without somebody starting a treatment center or a rehab or a dry out asylum or whatever. And they were really unregulated. There was good ones and there was bad ones, but there was a million of them. And what happened was by 1975, the membership in Alcoholics Anonymous had doubled. We went from 500,000 in 1970 to 1,000,000 in 1975. And that's about the time where the discussion meetings really got a start. And why do you think that is? Has anybody in here ever been in treatment? You ever been to a group? You ever done group where you sit around in a big circle and you talk about what's going on with your day? Well, that's where the closed-minded discussion meeting came from. And I'm sitting here last night. I'm sitting here and I'm listening to this woman. And I'm going. Oh my God! Does she have a sponsor? You know, where did she learn that she could do this and then share like she's proud of her monumental dysfunction? And I thought, what kind of a message is that if there's a newcomer in the room, you know? Yeah, you can be a complete horse's ass, and I'm sober today. You know, I mean, that's a terrible message. So I don't like to do this. I don't like to do this. But I raised my hand and I shared. And, you know, I basically shared, I tried to keep it on my experience because I don't like to shame anybody or, you know, make anybody, you know, feel bad. But I basically shared about what is alcoholism. Alcoholism is the manifestation of chronic and critical self-centeredness. That's what alcoholism is. We drink in reaction to the catastrophic effects of being as self-centered and self-involved as we are. We need to escape from the bondage of self that it talks about in the big book. The bondage of our self-centeredness. The bondage of thinking like we're the only one here and this is a hostile universe, you know. Of course you're going to need to drink if that's what you've built the foundation of your life on, you know. So I'm talking about this self-centeredness, and I'm talking about it from my own perspective. And I'm saying, look, I am decades into this Alcoholics Anonymous thing. And I've been practicing the 12-step principles for well over two decades in my life. And still today, I can feel the effects of my chronic self-centeredness. Before the meeting that day, my wife's daughter shows up at the house with the two grandchildren. Now, it's a 1.5-year-old boy and a 3-year-old boy. So, they're running around the house, and I got to tell you, they're getting into everything. You know, they're grabbing the electrical cords. I mean, our house is not baby proof. So, you got to be on this, you know. And I had stuff to do. All of a sudden, I'm like the grandpa, you know, running around totally trying to make sure that and it's going against what I want to do. I can feel the selfishness within me. You know, these kids are interrupting the project that I'm working on. You know, this is decades into this work. I still have this self-centeredness. Listen, the good news was it was all about these two kids. And every moment that they were over my house, it was all about these two kids. But inside, I was being pulled because at the core, at depth, I am selfish, I'm self-centered, and I am self-involved. And that's what alcoholism is. So I'm sharing this, and then I basically share what I totally believe and what has come from my own personal experience. And that is, to share in a meeting about all my problems does me absolutely no good at all. It will not help me at all. What will help me is if I recognize these resentments, or I recognize these fears, or I recognize that my conduct is wrong, I need to inventory it. This is what Alcoholics Anonymous teaches us to do. We need to inventory it. Then we need to share it with somebody, whether it's a sponsor or a spiritual advisor. Then we need to become willing to have God remove these defects of character. Because I've got to tell you, your character defects, if you're anything like me, they are much larger than you. If you could have been a better person when you were out there robbing and pillaging, you probably would have. You know what I mean? Because we're driven. We're driven sometimes to be the type of people that we are. You know, so we got to come to terms with God removing these defects of character. We have to humbly ask God to remove these defects of character. And then we need to become willing to make amends for where these character defects have caused harm to other people or institutions. And I'm basically sharing this, kind of aiming it at this woman who just dumped a huge amount of garbage on the floor. Stuff that if I was sponsoring her, she would have an amends list out the door, you know, hopefully trying to get a little bit of a message across that Alcoholics Anonymous is not group therapy. It is incredibly far from group therapy. If Bob Newhart group therapy would have worked, you know, we would have gotten sober the first time we went to Happy Hills Treatment Center. And if you're anything like me, that is not the case. My alcoholism was much more aggressive than sitting in a group was going to treat. You know, I was going to a gunfight with a penknife. Now, my alcoholism, what does my alcoholism look like? I totally, truly believe today that I used to think that I'm an alcoholic because I drink a lot. I now truly believe that I drank a lot because I was an alcoholic. Those are two completely different things. Listen, folks, the science is coming in. This is a genetic bullet, okay? It's not causal. It's not because you grew up next to a bar. It's not because your mother or your father left you. It's genetic. It's a genetic component. And what happens is we are genetically predisposed to exhibit selfish and self-centered behavior, which is going to lead to us trying to fill a spiritual vacancy within us with alcohol or sex or toys or food or gambling or something. We are not right within ourselves. There's a vacancy within us. And I recognized this vacancy back when I was about 5 years old. And really what it looked like was this. My mother came down the stairs and she said, you know, pack your stuff, get dressed, pack your stuff. Today's your first day at kindergarten. So I go, okay, all right. I'm not real happy about this, but, you know, I get in the car and she drives me across town. She opens up the door. She hands me my Snoopy lunchbox and she says, there's the classroom, go. And she closes the door and she drives away. And I remember I'm standing up here on a hill and the school is down below a little bit. And there's kids that are already playing with each other. They're running around playing tag and kickball. And I'm standing up there on this hill looking down, feeling like a dick. You know what I mean? I'm up there. I'm going like, oh, my God. You know, what if they don't like me? You know, what if I get in a fight? What if I get thrown out of school? What if, you know, what if I'm ostracized? I mean, you know, all this stuff is going through my head. I am filled with self-centered fear. I am filled with a sense of separation from my fellow man and from God. I am totally filled with self-centeredness. But I knew I had to do this. I couldn't, like, run home. You know, so I went down there and I did the kindergarten thing, feeling unbelievably self-conscious the whole time. Now, what would have worked really good on that day would have been a pint of vodka. I got to tell you. You know, I'm telling you, you know, it was a problem that I didn't have it because I didn't have my cure for that self-centeredness. The cure for that being apart from and not connected to, later became alcohol. That was my cure for this spiritual malady, this spiritual vacancy in my life. Now, I go through about 8 years of school just pretending everything's okay. You know, when I first came into AA, they used to say, you know, yeah, sometimes you have to act as if until it's true. Well, you know, I was good at acting as if. I was acting as if everything was okay when I was going to school. Everything was not okay. Right? I didn't like crowds. I didn't want to raise my hand. I didn't like to get, you know, to have to give oral reports. There's a million things that I didn't like about school. And then one day, I'm about 12 years old, and me and two of my buddies decide we're going to cut school, we're going to go back to my house, and we're going to do this thing called getting drunk. We'd heard about this, and we'd seen it on the TV shows, you know. I'd seen it on Westerns, you know, John Wayne, you know, busting through the saloon doors, bartender, whiskey! And the bartender would bring a bottle of whiskey out, and he'd pour a big water glass of whiskey, drink it, he'd grab the bottle, he'd go back to the table, you know, and he'd be about the business of drinking. So that's what I thought drinking was. So I pulled down a bottle of whiskey, and I poured three big water glasses for me and my buddies. Now, first, I want to tell you what my buddies did, because this is just as significant as what I did. My two buddies had about two-thirds of their glass of whiskey, and they'd had enough. You ever drink with people that have enough on you? You know, isn't that annoying? Oh, my God, had enough. What is enough? You know, enough isn't even a word that we understand. We know more, and we know mine, you know, but we don't understand enough. So they'd had enough, and they sat back and they watched the show. Because what happened was I drank my glass, I drank the rest of their glasses, I drank the rest of the bottle, and here I am 12 years old and a blackout drunk, trashing the house. I mean, I came to out in the field not knowing how I'd even got there. It was completely bizarre. you know, I busted windows and smashed stuff in the house. I went completely out of control. And when I got back to the house, I started going through that first hangover. You know what I mean? That first experience of being really hungover, where you discover projectile vomiting. You know, I mean, it was really brutal. And for 2 days, I had to stay horizontal. Now, getting that sick on something, you know, it should have sent a mental signal to me. Hey, you got really sick. This didn't work. You know, you feel worse than you've ever felt in your life. Maybe you shouldn't do this anymore. I mean, that would be a normal reaction to getting really, really drunk. And it's funny. My first wife, that's exactly what happened to her. She got really drunk on vodka and she never drank hard liquor again. Go figure. But what happened to me was, when I started drinking that whiskey, that scared kindergartner disappeared. That sense of self and that sense of self-centered fear and anxiety and all of that pent-up emotion that I'd been living with for years was gone. And all of a sudden, I had no fear. I felt larger than life. And you were lucky to be hanging out with me. You know what I mean? I mean, I felt gigantic. And I never, ever forgot that feeling. From that moment forward, I started to look at alcohol as a solution to my inner turmoil. And I started to use it as such. And over any considerable period of time, alcoholism gets worse. It does not get better. I started to get in a lot of trouble. I started to get in DUIs, later on I started to drive. And I mean, you know, I drank. If I was going to go to a party, I would get half drunk before I'd go to the party. If I was going to go to a bar, I'd have like a half a pint of blackberry brandy or something before I'd go to the bar. I mean, that's the kind of drinker I was. And I started to crash cars. You know, the first DUI I got, I was at this country bar, you know, out in the woods, and we were chugging pitchers of beer. Now, you know, they've got the 24 question pamphlet or whatever. You know, that should be one. You know, if you chug pitchers of beer, you probably have a problem. But I remember, you know, beer all over me. It was just a mess. I end up getting into my car. I made it about a mile and a half down the road, and it was winter. And I hit some black ice, and I spun around, and I hit a bridge abutment going backwards at about 30 miles an hour. And I actually broke through the seat and out the back window. And when I came to, my legs were still in the car, but I was lying on the trunk looking up at the sky. And I thought, uh-oh, this isn't good. But it's a Toyota, right, that I'm driving, so it's still running. So I get back in it. You know, I get back in it. Now you gotta picture this car. It had three flat tires. There was not a window left in it. It was like bent like a boomerang. The drive shaft was slapping the frame. It was just a mess. And I start driving. And about a half a mile later, I drive right by a cop taking radar. And, you know, he's like, he doesn't even pull me over. He walks me over because I'm doing about a mile and a half an hour. Bam, 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 down the road, right? And he reaches in through the non-window and starts shaking me. Where did you have that accident? I'm like, what do you mean, officer? What accident? His glass flying out of my hair. You know, get out of the car. You know, he goes, and, you know, that's my first DUI, you know. You know how cops are. He goes, where are you going? And I go, Basking Ridge. He goes, that's like 25 miles. You don't have any tires. And I'm like, stop hassling me, you know. You cops are always hassling me. So, you know, I had like 9 car accidents. I'll fast forward to my last car accident, all right? Now, I allow myself to become overserved at a bar. You know, that would happen to me quite often. And I'll never forget. I'm at this bar, and I'm really drunk because I got drunk before I went out with my buddy. And I remember sitting there at the bar drinking my triple bourbon and coke. I mean, you know, when you order a triple bourbon from a bartender, they know there's trouble coming. You know what I mean? They're going to be watching you. But anyway, I'm sitting there drinking my triple bourbon, and I look over, and there's a table of four young, attractive women, and I think to myself, you know, they would really benefit from my company, you know. You know, I'm pretty drunk, so I start heading that way, and I'll never forget. I'm about halfway there, and they look over, they see me coming, and they're like, oh no, they're like horrified, like, oh my God. I get almost there, and I trip on my feet, and I land on their table, and send all their drinks into their lap, you know, real class, you know. So my buddies like drag me outside. Well, anyway, later that night, I make it to about a half a mile away from my house. Supposedly, I crossed the double yellow. You know how cops are. Anyway, they pull me over, and knocks on the window. You know, I roll down the window. Oh, what do you want, officer? He's like, license, registration, insurance card. So I'm like, it's my mother's car. I wrecked mine. So I'm looking through the glove compartment trying to find the registration and the insurance card. I know it's in there somewhere, but there's tissues and maps and all kinds of stuff. And I'm struggling. I'm looking through all this stuff. You know, about a minute or two's gone by. Finally, I just give up. And I grab the entire contents of the glove compartment, and I hand it to the cop, right? And you know how they are. He's like, get out of the car! You know, and so he does some field sobriety. Now, does anybody in here remember hazy recollections? You know, they talk about that in the big book. That's like when you're borderline blackout, but you can remember little bits and pieces. Well, what happened was I remember going up to the police station, and I remember some sobriety tests, and one of them was to do the ABCs. And I got to tell you, I nailed the ABCs. I know I did. Has nothing to do with me learning them when I'm three, you know, but I nailed the ABCs. I remembered it. So the next day when I wake up and I've got my summons in my pocket, I'm thinking, you know, this is a travesty of justice. You know, I'm going to hire an attorney. So I do. I hire this attorney, and he goes, okay, I'll represent you, because I refused the breathalyzer. I was indignant. Now, what happened was the attorney gets a hold of the police station, and the first thing we've got to do is go up and view the VHS tape that was taken during my... Has anybody in here ever seen your DUI videotape? I highly recommend never doing that, okay? You know, it will cause a lot of money in therapy. I'm there with this really expensive lawyer, three-piece suit. You know, we go in there, and I should have known it was a problem, because when the cop was handing my lawyer the tape, and we're going into the room with the TV, he goes like this. And I'm like, oh no. Sure enough, as soon as he turns it on, I am horrified. I am tongue chewing drunk. I am so drunk. There, you know, and I'm like, oh my God. And there's actual video where they're saying, Mr. Shorter, please don't hold on to the police officer while you're walking the line. I'm like walking the line, like holding on to the cop. It was a nightmare. And you know, we get to the place where I've told the lawyer I did a good job, the ABCs. And I did them like this. A, B, can I have a cigarette? C. Oh, it was horrifying. It was mortifying, right? So I'm like, I'm holding my head down. And but the lawyer, I'm paying him $1,500. This is like 1983, right? So he's taking notes. He's real prim and proper. And we get to the end of the tape. And the cop goes, Mr. Schroeder, we're going to turn off the tape now, but we want to give you a chance to add anything. Do you have anything else to say? And I'm like, oh, no. And sure enough, I look right into the camera and I go, oh, like this, right? I'm like, oh, no. And the attorney who's been as serious as he just breaks out laughing. He's going, bah! I've never seen anything so stupid in my life. Oh, my God. You know, if we had any chance at all, you just blew it. And I'm like, okay, I guess we'll plea. You know, I mean, I walked half of the 80s, you know, on that one. You know, listen, when I'm looking back, you know the crazy thing is, we're not stupid people. We're not really crazy people. You know, but as alcoholics, we do stupid and crazy things. It's just absolutely nuts, some of the stuff that we do. I remember this time, I lived about 45 minutes outside of New York City. And this is the 70s, some of the heyday of my partying. And I remember going into the city. We all jumped in a van and we went into the city. I think it was a Foghat Wishbone Ash concert or something. Anyways, like the Academy of Music, and I'm half drunk out of my mind. And I remember me and my buddy going, hey, let's go into the bathroom and see if we can find some drugs, you know. So we go in the bathroom and there's some guys selling acid in there, and these kids. So we go, oh, let's buy, you know, we buy some acid, we eat the acid. Well, but we're both drunk, so like 10 minutes later, we're like, we're not high, we got ripped off. So we go back to the bathroom, we buy more acid, right? And then we're passing it around to our buddies and we're eating. Well, about 10 minutes later, we're still not high, so we got ripped off again. So we go back. Now it's the end of the concert and we're like this. I mean, it's like Disney World, you know. I mean, it's just like, we make it out to the van, and everybody's just we make it out to the van, and we're driving. Everybody here knows the Lincoln Tunnel. I'm sure most of the people here have experienced the Lincoln Tunnel. It's like 10 lanes, 8 lanes, 6 lanes, 4 lanes, 2 lanes, tunnel, right? Well, we're heading down to the tunnel, and somebody up in the front of the van goes, hey man, we'll never fit, right? And so we all start moving up in front, and we're looking out the window. He's going, he's right. He's right. It's a mouse hole. We'll get stuck, right? So has anybody in here tried to back out of the Lincoln Tunnel? It took us like 45 minutes. Everybody beeping. You know, we took the bridge. Oh, I mean, you know, stuff like this was happening to us all the time. You know, because listen, when I did drugs, I did them alcoholically. I always used them to enhance my ability to drink or to help me with the effects of the hangover or the alcohol poisoning. That's almost always why I used them. I remember this one time, it's 1972. It's the great Quaalude epidemic in Baskin Ridge, New Jersey, okay? The real cool thing about this is the guy that brought these into school in 1972, I just did a big book workshop with him in Tampa, Florida, believe it or not. I mean, just amazing that we're both still alive. But he comes in, his brother had given him a big bag of Quaaludes to sell. And it's first period in the morning, you know, just before first period, we're out in the smoking area. And he goes, look what I got. You know, everybody's, you know, crowding around. What do you got? What do you got? They're called Quaaludes. And we're like, oh, okay. How much are they? They're $1 a piece. You know, okay. Well, how many do you do? And he goes, I don't know. I haven't done them yet. 2 or 3. Oh, my God. So, listen, anybody that doesn't know what a Quaalude is, a Quaalude is like instantly drinking a six-pack of malt liquor or something. I mean, they noodle you. They quickly became really illegal because of all the... I mean, the problem when you were doing them is you'd feel okay, but if you had to get up to go across the room to turn the channel on the TV, you'd break every piece of furniture in between you and the TV. It was terrible. So anyway, like 50 of us do 2 or 3 Quaaludes before first period. It was a debacle. The ambulance was back and forth all day long. I remember by third period, I was walking down the hall, hanging on to the lockers like this, and I see an exit sign. I see an exit sign. I go, exit, exit. That would be a good idea right about now. I'm going to exit. So I broke through the school doors and I headed to the woods. And it's in front of like the whole 400 wing, right? So I made it out to the woods, and when I get out there, there's already people out there like holding on to trees and stuff. It was really bad. But the next day at school, people were like laughing at me and stuff. And I'm like, what are you laughing at? And they go, Chris, do you remember yesterday, like about third period when you broke for the woods? I go, yeah. He goes, it took you 5 minutes to go 100 yards. I'm like, I thought I was hauling ass. You know what I mean? I thought I was moving. Oh. But this kind of stuff was always happening to me. I mean, it got to the point where my alcoholism was so bad that I was suffering from the delirium tremens in the morning. And really what that is that's the shakes, and it's like the anxiety, and you're like really nervous and high strung, and you get pissed off and loud noises, and you can't deal and you can't think. And I remember going to a doctor and saying, "Doc, you know, I'm like anxious and I'm always nervous and you know, I always feel bad, you know." And he takes out his stethoscope and he puts it on my heart. And because I'm detoxing, my heart is going bloop 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 bloop. So he goes, "Whoa!" He goes, "It sounds like you've got a mitral valve problem, and I think it's being caused by acute anxiety." And I go, "Okay, doc, sounds good. You got anything for that?" And he goes, "Yeah, we've got this new drug called Xanax. You know, it's brand new." And I go, "Well, what kind of milligrammages does it come in, doc? Because I'm going to need the big ones." So he gives me these Xanax. And I got to tell you, within a couple of months, I wasn't counting them anymore. I was weighing them. I would pour a whole bunch out into my hand. And gigantic letters on the pill bottle, "No alcohol," you know, with these things, right? So I'd eat about 20, and I drink about almost a quart of vodka like every night. I got to tell you, I was noodled. I didn't know a sober moment for like 6 months. And I'm an electrician, you know? So I'm blowing stuff up. I'm, you know, the stuff that I was doing was just bad. I was drilling into people's closets and pulling suit coats through the hole. And, you know, this one time I wired up a kitchen to the wrong panel. And it was the hot water heater panel, so the kitchen would go on at 8 at night and you know, I'd go off at 8 in the morning, you know. I was like, oh my God, you know, some of the stuff that I did. Probably the stupidest thing I ever did was I was drilling holes in the floor to run data cable. This is when computers were brand new, like the early 80s, and you had to string data cable between the cash registers so that they could network with each other. So I'm drilling a hole in the floor in the middle of the lingerie section of a place called Bamberger's, which was basically like a Macy's. And this drill has a giant auger bit about this long with a big extension because there's all kinds of stuff you got to drill through. And it's one of those old, like 5 horsepower big steel with bar handles and locking trigger. It was like a 1950 drill. And I'm drilling and I'm drilling down and I'm looking around because it's like the lingerie section, you know, and I'm not paying much attention. And all of a sudden the thing hangs up on a piece of rebar. And I bear down on it, and the trigger locks. So all of a sudden, it starts doing this. It starts spinning me around. It spins me around. It ties me up in the cord, and then rips the pants off my ass. Okay? Finally, it unplugs from the wall, and I'm hanging here like this, you know, with my pants all bloody, you know, and all these women, like, you know, looking at me. And you don't want to look stupid, you know what I mean? So you're, "Oh, yeah, this always happens with this drill." Yeah. Can you twist me around a couple times? You know, it's just crazy. You know, so my life had become just an absolute debacle. Now, I'm fairly intelligent, you know, and the last couple of years, what was going on was I was living in a room at my mother's house, drinking for oblivion. It talks about, on page like 7 of Bill's story, he talks about, you know, 2 bottles of gin and then oblivion. Now, I know what and how he was drinking in those last days, how Bill was drinking, and I can relate to it because inside my head was so much turmoil. So much fear, so much resentment. You know, I would come to in the morning. This would be a perfect day. I would pass out in the clothes I went to bed with the night before. I'd come to in the morning, and the first thing when my head comes off the bed, the first thing I'd think is, "Those bastards." I mean, I'd start to think about the people that I was pissed at. So I was dying of resentment. I was dying of anxiety. And life was becoming almost unbearable. You know, the sad thing about alcoholism is, if you're an alcoholic, you're about 60 times more likely to take your own life than a non-alcoholic. You know, those are the statistics. We check out. We get to the point where it talks about in the Vision for You. We get to a point where the hideous 4 horsemen gallop through our head: terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair. And we get to a place that they describe as pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And that's what happens to us. It is an unbelievably sad thing. But that's what happens to us. And we can't take it anymore. Some of us get lucky and we get exposed to treatment or the recovery process, and we find our way in here and we find a way to deal with sobriety. Because, listen, the great lesson Bill and Dr. Bob learned way back when was you don't fight alcoholism with sobriety. They tried it 1,000 times. It never lasts. You fight alcoholism with spiritual living. You have to learn how to live a spiritual life in a certain way. And that enables us, basically, this is what it looks like. In step two, we have to come to terms that there's a power greater than ourselves that can restore us to sanity. In step three, we make a decision to align ourselves with that power, to seek that power, to develop a relationship with that power. That's the solution to alcoholism. And what it basically looks like is we find a way to practice the steps in our lives. We find a way to practice certain spiritual principles in our lives. And what that does is that places us in the sunlight of the Spirit. And when we're in the sunlight of the Spirit, the power greater than ourselves can come down and remove the obsession to drink and enable us to become happily and usefully whole. It's a great line in the 12 and 12. The 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life will expel the obsession to drink and enable the user to become happily and usefully whole. So basically what we do is we engage the actual power of God. We engage that. And we can get to the grace, but to enable us to be ready to accept the grace of God, we need to be engaged in a spiritual practice, a spiritual path. And that's what Bill and Bob and the early people in Alcoholics Anonymous discovered. Now, I do a lot of stuff in professional addiction treatment. This weekend coming up is what's known as the Cape Cod Symposium on Addictive Disorders. It's the absolute best symposium for treatment professionals. You know, the people that we go to when we go to treatment centers and stuff. It's got the absolute best in the field there, and I'll be going up there for probably the 8th year in a row. I'm on a board up there, and so I travel around the professional addiction and alcoholism treatment world, and I know some things about what they do. I believe that treatment is about discovery, and I believe the 12 steps are about recovery. I believe that a lot of us, maybe even most of us, need some kind of exposure to either detox or a treatment process to be able to get our feet underneath us, to be able to start doing what we need to do to participate in the maintenance of our spiritual condition. I believe that. So I'm a big proponent of the better treatment centers and the better recovery centers and the better detoxes. I think that we really do need them. But every once in a while, there'll be a treatment professional who just won't get it. They'll be so clinical that they won't understand the spiritual capacity in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm on several LinkedIn groups with these professionals. And this one day, one of these guys really pissed me off. And this was an addiction psychiatrist, okay? This is somebody that charges you $300 an hour to sit in his office, and he'll help you with your drug addiction or your alcoholism. This is somebody that really should know what he's doing. And he was criticizing Alcoholics Anonymous and 12-step fellowships really heavily. And I kind of took exception to this, so I threw a couple of insults his way. And we got back and forth in this. And finally, here's what he did. He sent me this. He goes, Chris, I've got to tell you, I don't recommend anybody to go to Alcoholics Anonymous anymore. Alcoholics Anonymous has about a 6% recovery rate. I can do better prescribing placebos. That's what this addiction psychiatrist said. So I'm like, first of all, I'm really mad at him. But a lot of times you have to internalize. Sometimes you have to like listen, like, what is he saying? And I started to realize, yes, there are statistics out there
people that get these statistics usually go to a metropolitan area and they stand outside the door with a clipboard and they ask you, you know, how long you've been here, how many days you have, you know, how many times have you relapsed, and all this stuff. And they actually get data that provides backup that we are. We're about, if you walk through that door, you have about a 6% chance of being sober in 2 to 5 years. You have about a 6% chance. Now, that's true if you're taking your statistics from the door to a meeting. But that's not what the recovery process is. So I'm thinking, you know, how do I rebut this guy? How do I go back at this guy? And here's what I came up with. I wrote him and I said, okay, let's say you come up with a cure for a certain type of cancer and you're absolutely sure it works. And you set up shop at a hospital, and let's say 100 people come in with that type of cancer, and they're coming in to your hospital, and you've got the cure, and only 10% of them go into the operating room and get the procedure. The rest of the 90% sit in the waiting room and talk about cancer, and talk about cancer recovery, and exchange phone numbers with each other, and get a cancer recovery sponsor. But they never go in for the treatment. I asked them, I go, if you were figuring out what your statistics were and the 10 people that went in for the treatment, all 10 of them recovered from cancer, would you say that you had a 10% recovery rate? And he said, no, absolutely not. Only the people that would go through the procedure would even be counted. Well, I go, you're counting people who don't go through the procedure in Alcoholics Anonymous. Here's what I know. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. That was true in the late 30s, and it's still true today. The problem is, it's become okay to show up in Alcoholics Anonymous and not be held accountable to a recovery process. It's okay to sit in the back and just let time take time. Believe me, that is not what was going on in the first 15 years of AA. If you weren't firmly involved in the steps and making amends, they didn't want you in the meetings. Because you needed to show that you meant business. And what meaning business meant was you were willing to do the 12-step recovery process. And that's really what's happened to Alcoholics Anonymous today. There are way too many of us sitting in the waiting room. You know, we're not going in for the spiritual operation, the 12-step recovery process. Here's basically what happened to me. I'm sober a while. I come into Alcoholics Anonymous after a really bad relapse. I'd been in AA before. I'd been through treatment. I'd been through outpatient. You know, I knew alcohol was killing me. I show up in Alcoholics Anonymous and I am absolutely desperate. I'm going to maybe 12 meetings a week. You know, I am just doing every possible thing I can. I'm going to work. I'm coming home. I'm taking a nap. Then I'm getting up, I'm eating something, I'm going off to a meeting, and then I'm going to a diner with somebody after the meeting. I'm packing every spare moment that I'm not working. I'm doing AA. On Saturday, I would go to 3 or 4 meetings. I mean, I was absolutely desperate. But all I'm doing is going to meetings. And it's about 7 or 8 months in, right? And I, you know, I remember sitting in this meeting. And I would sit in the meeting and, you know, I would give the normal traditional AA response to, hey, Chris, how you doing? Good. Fine. Everything's good. Sober. You know, didn't drink today. You know, I would give all that lip flap back to people. But what was going on inside me was absolutely nuts. I'll give you a for instance. This one time I remember walking down into the basement, into this meeting, and I sat down, you know, you know, it's a discussion meeting, and I'm like, you know, there's 80% of the people in the meeting I don't like for one reason or another. You know, I'm turbo judgmental. And, you know, I remember this one person sharing, and I'm like, oh, my God, listen to this hypocrite share. Oh, I can't even believe it. You know, what a lying scumbag, you know, and I'm sitting there like this. And then I look over, and I see, you know, he's done, and I see this guy. Oh, my God, he what's his name is raising his hand. Oh, God, oh, please don't call on him. Oh, don't call him. Don't call. Oh, my God, they called on him. Oh, now I'm going to have to hear about him. Share about his family, you know. Will you tell somebody who cares, please? Oh, now he's grateful. Oh, listen to this. I'll tell you what. I'm going to go out in the parking lot and slash all four of his tires. I'm going to follow him out after the meeting because I want to see what gratitude really looks like, you know. And I'm sitting there like this. Thanks for sharing. You know, I mean, this is what's going on in my head. I am absolutely out of my mind. You know, and I'm acting as if I'm not a complete lunatic in these meetings. Now, what happened with me was this guy, Radio Shack Mike. He was like my first buddy in AA. Because, listen, I was scary in the early days. I really was. I was like a garage door spring. I mean, you could tell that, you know, there was like 5,000 pounds of, you know, repressed power, you know. And I just could snap at any minute. And so people would give me a wide berth. But anyway, this one guy, Radio Shack Mike, became my friend just because he was, like, touched in the head. But, you know, we're buddies. And this guy was one of those guys that, he was happy to be sober. You know, what it was he got arrested for some cocaine and, you know, went through a treatment center to stay out of jail, came to AA, you know, by mistake. And, you know, everything was wonderful from, like, his first day because he wasn't an alcoholic, you know. He's like this all the time. And I'm like, I can't believe, could you hear, what's his name, share? And he would go to a lot of New Age bookstores a lot of times. I remember he gave me a set of tapes on affirmations, you know. And listen, I love affirmations. They're really great. But don't try to treat your alcoholism with them, you know. Because here I was this one day, you know. It says, go to the mirror and repeat, you know, 100 times, Chris, you're a wonderful guy. So I'm like, Chris, you're a wonderful guy. Chris, you're a wonderful guy. I'm a scumbag, you know. No, I'm not a wonderful guy. I mean, it just was not working for me, you know. I was trying to stop a semi with a cobweb. And because my alcohol, I had a bad case of alcoholism. So this one time he comes up to me and he goes, here, Chris, I want you to check these guys out. I go, what is that? He goes, it's a big book study. A couple of guys did a big book study. I'm like, you know, 8 90-minute tapes. I'm like, 8 90-minute tapes, a big book study? I mean, I had a big book. It was given to me when I was in treatment. I hadn't touched it since. You know, I opened it up the other day, and it's beautiful. My treatment big book, it's got like, Chris, you're the craziest bastard I ever met. You're never going to make it. Love, Harry. You know, I mean, it's, you know, all the guys signed it, you know, before I got released. But anyway, he hands me these tapes and he makes me promise to listen to him. He goes, these guys are hardcore. I didn't really like it, you know, but you might like it. And what they were was, it was an early big book study by Joe and Charlie. Now, I started listening to this big book study, and the first thing I did was I got pissed, because it was very apparent that what Joe and Charlie were saying was, if you're not working the steps out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, you do not have an AA program, because that's what an AA program is. If you're going to meetings like a maniac, that's great. You can be the pope of the meetings, but you have no AA program. Now, that infuriated me, because I was going to like 14 meetings a week. I was a coffee maker over here. I was a treasurer over there. I was driving the boobies from the hatch to the meeting. I was going out afterward to the diner. I was sharing. I learned how to share, you know. And I, like, people were patting me on the head. Chris, you're doing really good. You're doing really good. So these tapes infuriated me. And, you know, first thing I thought was, you know, that may be what you do in Arkansas. That may be how they do AA in Arkansas, but this is New Jersey. We share in New Jersey. You know what I mean? Don't need to hear this crap. Now, what happened was, alcoholism over any considerable period of time, it's going to get worse, it's not going to get better. If you're not treating your alcoholism with a spiritual program, three things will happen. One, you'll drink. Two, you'll kill yourself. Three, you'll go crazy. Those are the three things. I don't care how many meetings you're going to. If you're really alcoholic and you're not practicing a spiritual program of recovery somehow, That's what's going to happen to you. You're going to get drunk, you're going to shoot yourself, or you're going to go crazy. Now, I'm slowly going crazy. Now, some stuff happened in my life. Probably there's people in here who relate to a sober bottom, you know, like a series of circumstances. What happened was a state caught up with me that I had fled to avoid prosecution. I had problems with Trenton Motor Vehicle. My girlfriend broke up with me and I lost my job, like all within a 2-week period of time. So I was not doing well. Now, I'd listened to these tapes. The message in those tapes haunted me because Joe and Charlie spoke with such authority. They knew what they were talking about. You could just tell, you know, and I had to come to terms with this. Joe and Charlie were right, and everybody in the meetings and groups that I was going to was wrong. You know, that's what had to be true. If Joe and Charlie is right, all of my sponsor and all the groups I'm in are wrong. And I had to come to terms with that. And how I did it was, I got to the point where I was willing to try what they were talking about. Listen, I had no other plans, and I didn't do it out of any sense of virtue. I just couldn't stand feeling the way I felt. I was so dry, I was a fire hazard. And I was so emotionally damaged and in pain. And spiritual pain, it was horrible. So what I did was I took these tapes off the shelf. I opened up my big book. I got a notebook and a pen. And I started going through these tapes. And where they asked me to do something, I would stop and I would do it. I would pause the tape. I would do it. And then when I had done it, I would move on. I did it the way they were talking about, like it's a textbook. The big book, like it's a textbook. You know... When I first got a big book, I read it like it was the Da Vinci Code. I read it in treatment. You know, 2 days later, okay, got it. You know, what else you got for me? Because this really, you know, this is really poorly written and Bill was a loser. You know, I mean, that's what I thought. I read through it so fast. But a textbook is something that is to be studied and you are to do the exercises. I'll give you a for instance. Let's say you want to get the calculus experience. You need calculus to be able to do the financial calculations that you may have in your job. So you go to a calculus class, you know, Calculus 101, and you sit in there and you get a book, but you don't open it. But you like to go to the class and you like to ask questions or share, you like to share about calculus and, you know, go out to the diner with everybody in the calculus classroom afterward, you know. You're grateful for calculus. But you never open the book. I mean, would that not be crazy? You've never done the exercises, so you can't solve the problems. Well, that's what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't do the exercises. We don't learn how to do inventory. We don't learn how to meditate and pray. We don't learn how to do these things. So we can't solve the problems. So we raise our hand in the discussion meeting and we vomit our crap all over the group. You know, that has become common in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's a shame. It's a shame because rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And the enormity of the promises in the book Alcoholics Anonymous is unbelievable. The most satisfactory years of your life are ahead of you. What a great promise that is. You know, you'll understand the word serenity. You know, frequent contact with newcomers will be the high spot of your life. You'll intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle you. You'll be rocketed into the fourth dimension of reality. The consciousness of the presence of God will be a working piece of your life. The consciousness of the presence of God. People go to church 100 years trying to get the consciousness of the presence of God. And we get it in 12 very, very simple but very, very intense steps. Alcoholics Anonymous is about two things, folks. It's about freedom and it's about power. Lack of knowledge is not our problem, not our dilemma. Lack of good people in our lives is not our problem. Lack of power is our problem. So what we do is we practice a set of spiritual principles that enables the absolute power of God to work in and through us. This is an amazing program. And when this is happening with you, you have no idea where your life can go. I went from being a terrible, terrible electrician. I mean, I blew things up on a daily basis. I electrocuted myself so much my hair would stick up like Ignatowski on Taxi. And Chris, what did you blow up today? It was terrible. Well, once I got sober and I started practicing recovery principles, I started to become more ethical. I started to become more honest. I started to become more dependable. I started to become more promotable. You know, I went from a terrible electrician to today, I'm a facility manager with a $12 million budget running a huge piece of business for a pharmaceutical manufacturing plant. You know, in this plant, we manufacture life-saving medication. We manufacture the medication that cures malaria. You know, you think that isn't important? Do you know that the mosquito is still the single biggest killer in the world today? You know, so that's a very, very important job. I get to do that. You know, in my life, I've got so many good friends. I've got, Bobby, Lenny, I drive an hour and 45 minutes and I know a bunch of people in the meeting. I mean, that's how big my world has gotten. That self-centered fear, that anxiety, I still have a little bit of it, but the spiritual practices have moved enough of it away for me to be very, very effective in my life. The ability to do a lot of things. You know, I'm a board member on the National Council of Alcoholism and Drug Dependency, for God's sake. How did that happen? I graduated the second stupidest kid in my high school. I did. The guy who was worse than me couldn't even read. You know, because I was busy. I was busy partying. I was always, always stoned. You know, I'd be the guy in class going, "Wow." You know, I mean, I don't think I was straight for one class in high school. And these amazing things are happening. You know, I met a wonderful woman, an amazing woman. I knew her back in high school. We used to go see Led Zeppelin and Yes and Pink Floyd together. I mean, you know, we did a lot. She smoked some pot and she just watched me drink because that was worth the price of admission right there. But we got separated. We got, you know, we disappeared from each other's life. I went off to college. She moved two or three times, and we didn't see each other for 33 years. And then all of a sudden, she pops up on Facebook. And I'm like, "Oh my God, Andrea!" You know, so I send her a message. We go have coffee, and 2 months later we're living together, and 3 months later we're married. I mean, it's just it's crazy. But we so belong together, you know. I mean, we grew up together, and we both felt like we were home, you know, when we got together. That's amazing. I got to be an important piece in my family's life. I used to think. That I don't really come from a very close family, like we don't really do a lot together. And then when I started writing inventory, I started to see that, no, they're not close to me. They go on vacations together. They drive around the country together. They just don't bring me. You know what I mean? Because I was crazy. But I ended up being the person who helped my mother out in her last years. I've helped my brother and sister out a million different ways. I've helped out their children. You know, because I've become practical. I've got, an intuitive capacity to intuitively know what to do. That's working in my life, and I'm able to be helpful to other people. I got to tell you, folks, whatever you put into Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to get twice that back. But make no mistake, you have to put enough into AA to get enough back from AA to be able to stay here. Walking through that door is easy. Staying here year after decade is hard. And to be able to do that, you need to put enough into this to get enough back so that you want to stay. And that's really where I am today. Bobby, thank you so much for asking me to come out and speak.